Welcome, friends, and thank you as always. And today I want to be sure to thank not just John Lee Hooker, but also the other great musician on this track and on this album, Carlos Santana. The combination of them is extraordinary. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolff. Economic Update is a weekly program about what's happening in the economic parts of our lives. Our goal is to cover the most recent important events, but also to pick one key economic issue each week to examine in detail. A little bit later, I'm going to introduce you to my guest for today, Dr. Harriet Fraud, who's going to talk about a number of important questions related to how our economic system impacts our psychology and the reverse as well. The purpose of Economic Update now is to examine an economy in trouble and undergoing change. For economic change to really benefit the majority of people in this country, we have to know more than what is happening. We need to know how our economy could and should change in ways that would better serve our needs and our people. This program, Economic Update, aims to do all that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at www.rdwolf.com. I also want to thank Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. Please send us your questions and comments. Each week we will select one or more and respond on our program. Simply email your questions and comments to me, again, through the website rdwolf.com. If you're willing to have us use your name and town, please indicate that. Finally, please also become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles and information. You can post questions for me to answer on air there. I will answer some there and some on the air. So, folks, let's turn, before we have our interview, to some of the updates that deserve our attention, I think, based on things that have happened, particularly over the last week, but in longer run as well. First, there's been a lot of discussion about redistributing wealth. Conservatives accuse the Obama administration of being interested in or actually doing it. Conservatives get angry at all kinds of programs for people by accusing them of redistributing wealth and claiming that they would never want to do such a thing and they are against it in principle. The dishonesty of all of that is obvious if you're an economist, but I wanted to make sure you all understood that. So I went to a pro-business foundation. It's called the Tax Foundation, that keeps records of our taxes. And they do an interesting study based on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau in Washington. And here's what they do. They take all 50 of our states and they ask two simple questions. What's the amount of money sent to the federal government from each of the states? Basically, what are all the taxes they pay, the citizens of each state, that flows money into Washington? The other question they ask and answer is, how much money flows from Washington into each of the states? In other words, they measure how each state stacks up when it comes to money it sends to Washington and money it gets from Washington. And here's what it shows. The most recent statistics cover fiscal year 2005, but the numbers don't change that much for the basic picture. First of all, states in the American South and West are standouts. I'm going to give you some names in a minute. For states that get much more from Washington spent on them than they send to Washington. I'm going to read to you now the top 10 states that send less money to Washington than they get from Washington. They're the real beneficiaries. Ready? Here we go. New Mexico, Mississippi, Alaska, Louisiana, West Virginia, North Dakota, Alabama, Kentucky, Virginia. Get the picture? South, number one, and the West. Those are the states that get much more money from Washington than they send. Now I'm going to read to you the states that are the opposite, the ones that get back from Washington considerably less than they send. Here we go. In the order of the state which sends the most and gets back the least, that state is New Jersey. Here we go. New Jersey, Nevada, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Illinois, Delaware, California, New York, Massachusetts. Hello. The Northeast of the United States consistently sends to Washington much more money than it gets back to enable states in the South and West to collect from Washington more money than they send. How interesting, then, that it is people typically from the Northeast who are most supportive of what government programs are, and people in the South and West who tend not to recognize that they are the beneficiaries of a redistribution of wealth about which they seem to have nothing to say. Number two. There was a startling drug bust, in a sense, last week. More accurately, a major pharmaceutical giant in the United States, a company by the name of Johnson & Johnson, was found guilty and required to pay a fine of over $1.2 billion last Wednesday by a judge in Arkansas. This is because of a fraud alleged by the state of Arkansas, committed by Johnson & Johnson, related to its marketing of the drug Risperdal. Let me quote to you the State Attorney General Dustin McDaniel in Arkansas, describing the big win they had against Johnson & Johnson and its subsidiary, Janssen Pharmaceuticals. Quote, "These two companies put profits before people, and they are rightfully being held responsible for their actions." That's the word of Dustin McDaniel, the state attorney general in Arkansas. So I looked into this a little more, and here's what I found that I think will be of interest to you. This is one of several problems that Johnson & Johnson has had with this same drug, Risperdal. Wow. It has been found to have done this sort of thing elsewhere. Beyond that, I also found that other companies are having similar problems. In November of last year, the British drug company GlaxoSmithKline announced that it had agreed to pay $3 billion to settle federal investigation into its sales practices for several drugs, including Avandia, that's a drug for diabetes. In 2009, Pfizer, another pharmaceutical giant, settled for $2.3 billion over the marketing of something called Bextra, a painkiller that they make. And Eli Lilly in the same year got into trouble for the way it marketed Zyprexa, another antipsychotic drug, and they agreed to pay $1.4 billion in fines. Now, you might wonder, and I as an economist do that, whether this wouldn't kind of slow them down, being stuck with fines of the billions of dollars and statements by officials like attorney generals of states that they're crooked and that they put people after profits. But that is not the case. For example, immediately after it was announced last Wednesday that the state of Arkansas had reached this fine of over $1.2 billion on this company, Johnson & Johnson, here's what happened to its shares on the New York Stock Exchange. The beginning of the day, the shares were worth $64.20 per share. At the end of the day, after this tremendous news leaked out, their prices were $64.13. They dropped 7 cents. That's 0.00-something of a percentage. In other words, these fines don't make a difference. They're not big enough. They don't hurt the company enough to change its behavior, which is why there are so many examples for me to give you. It's a sign of an industry that's out of control, that is able to do things people now officially call grotesquely irresponsible in damaging people's health far and wide, but there's no effective mechanism in this system to prevent them from doing it over and over again. Third update for today. Some of you asked me, and this is, I know, a kind of a question, but so many of you did it. You were concerned about this famous capital gains tax that's in the news a great deal, and that is going to be a part of the election going forward between Obama and what's that fellow's name? Romney. And the question is capital gains tax. There are people in the Republican Party, notably Mr. Ryan, who writes their budget information, who want to get rid of the capital gains tax altogether. So I thought you might be interested in the history of the capital gains tax. First, let me explain what it is. Capital gain is a simple idea. It basically refers to shares of stock or bonds, securities of one kind or another. If you buy them at a certain price, say $10, and you hold them for a while, and then you sell them at another price, say $20, the difference between what you paid and what you get is called a capital gain. It's a kind of income that you earn by being able to sell something at a higher price than you paid for it. And the government taxes that. It puts a tax on that way of earning money. Now, obviously, it only affects the upper income people in this country because the majority of people either have no such things as stocks and bonds, or they have a trivial amount. So as a significant tax, it's really a tax on those at the top. So you can guess what's coming. In 1977, when the current economic problems of America really got into gear, I thought it was a convenient year to start. What was the tax on capital gains? Ready? 40%, 40. That means for every dollar you got by selling something at a higher price than you paid for it, you had to send Uncle Sam 40 cents, you got to keep 60. When Reagan came into office, 1981, it was dropped. It had actually been dropped a little bit earlier than that, but it was dropped to 20%. So the arrival of the late 70s and early 80s dropped this tax from the 40% to half of that, 20%. In 1986, it went back up because we had some terrible fiscal needs in this country, back up to 28%. But then in 1997, the Republicans and the Democrats agreed to drop it down again to 20%, and that was signed by President Clinton at the time, together with Mr. Gingrich, who was in power in the House of Representatives. And then when Bush came into office in 2003, he dropped it to 15%. So let's review. From 1977 at 40% to the current rate of 15%. That's a staggering drop. But more important even than that, and even more important than Mr. Romney's proposals, or at least Mr. Ryan's that Romney is favorable to cut it further, those last 30 years were years when people made more money by capital gains than probably at any comparable period in the history of the United States. It was the stock market boom to beat all booms. It was therefore a time when people with stocks were making money hand over fist. If ever it would have been legitimate to help the fiscal balance of the United States to avoid going into debt, it would have been to keep the rate at 40% and give the money, give the government the kind of money that would have come from a boom in the stock market paying 40%. Just when the rich could pay more, we found them able to drop the tax they had to pay from 40% to 15%. And maybe if the Republicans win, it'll go down even further. Well, I have more updates as usual, but I also have a guest, and she's more important. I want to introduce you all to Dr. Harriet Fraud. She is a practicing hypnotherapist and psychotherapist in New York City, has been for many years. She writes extensively on the intersection of American capitalism and our emotional lives and relationships. She and I do a regular podcast series on our website, the same one I introduced at the beginning of each program, www.rdwolf2fs.com. If you look there and click on Economy and Psychology, you'll see the conversations and analysis we produce together. Finally, she is the co-author, the lead author on a book co-authored by herself, Harriet Fraud, another author, Stephen Resnick, and myself, called Class Struggle on the Home Front. It is a book that tries to analyze the relationship between class and household and interpersonal dynamics. So I'm very happy to welcome you today, Dr. Fraud, to join with us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's get right into it. What I want to begin with is to ask you what so many people ask me and send in the way of questions. Can you give us, as a practicing hypnotherapist, psychotherapist, dealing with people's issues and problems and working with them every day, some sense how it appears to you in your work that the impacts of economic crisis, now in our fifth year, massive unemployment, people losing their homes, losing job benefits, becoming more insecure about their jobs. We don't hear enough or understand enough or acknowledge enough what kinds of personal, psychological, relational impacts that has. And I want you to talk about that because it's such an important and underappreciated dimension.
I would like to talk about that. And today I would like to talk about the way our capitalist system interacts with average people. We're going into our 11th recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And I would like to talk about what has happened in this great recession, which looks like a depression to me. Not being an economist, I see its emotional effects. And I'd like to talk about that in two different ways, with two different cases. In one case, I'd like to talk about one L. Goh, who shot seven classmates to death at Oikos Christian Vocational Nursing Program in Oakland, California.
That was just a couple weeks ago, right?
That was April 2nd.
Right.
And then, and what drove him to that, which has a lot to do with the recession and capitalism. Then I'd like to discuss the recent phenomenon of pornography addiction and the impact of pornography on the emotional relationships between men and women. Pornography is a wildly profitable item, more profitable than Google, Microsoft, and several different other companies put together. And so that it's a very different kind of illustration of the impact of capitalism on relationships.
All right, so we're going to start with the with an analysis, in a sense, your analysis of this case in Oakland, California.
Right. Both of my topics, by the way, illustrate different ways that U.S. capitalism creates emotional crises and then sells lucrative products that are addressed to the suffering that the capitalism created. And these products make huge money and at the same time immiserate people, make them even more miserable than they were before they got the products. In the case of one L. Goh, who we've all heard about after he shot, well, he shot more than seven classmates but managed to kill seven of his classmates, the product, the capitalist product, was an education from a Christian for-profit college nursing program. In the other case, as I said, the product is pornography. This is Juan L. Goh's story. Juan L. Goh had a decent job working on a construction site as a manager. That collapsed with the collapse of the housing industry, which is part of the general collapse that spread across the United States and decimated all but those who enriched themselves on it, like the countrywide financial executive Angelo Mozilla and the other CEOs of places like Countrywide Mortgage and large banks who got rich salaries followed by bailouts, while the construction workers and the construction managers and producers suffered. The same day that Juan L. Goh, this is what happened one day in the life of Juan L. Goh. On the same day he was evicted from his modest apartment.
The same day that he lost his job in the management?
He lost his job. No, it was a few months later when he was 2 months in arrears on his rent. He was in the same day evicted from his modest home and also watched his car being repossessed. He had nowhere to go. He also had some personal troubles. His brother was killed by a boulder that the California police or whoever is responsible hadn't removed from the road. And his mother died of grief shortly thereafter. Feeling he had no way and no place to go to reconstruct himself, to fit the American dream, to be a man of honor who he could respect, he moved in with his elderly father in a Christian senior housing complex.
If I could just interrupt, Dr. Prati, there is also this important qualifier. The statistics all point to an increasing number of people per apartment in the United States over the last several years. It's a classic example of what begins to happen in a sustained economic downturn, that you literally are pushing people together in living conditions, which, as we all know, can have all kinds of consequences on the way we live, given that what we're used to before these kinds of economic downturns impose these conditions. So he is very typical in that regard.
Yes, he is. Well, when Juan L. Goh moved in with his father in the elderly housing complex, he realized he liked working with older people, and he got the idea that he could recreate himself, do something socially useful that he enjoyed, work with elders, and become a nurse. He looked at a local Christian vocational education program at a for-profit college, Oikos College in Oakland.
By the way, again, just because it's so important, here is then a young person overtaken by economic downturns that are in no way his fault, trying to do exactly what people are told to do, which is not to rebel against the system that imposes this suffering on them, but to find a personal way out, to go try to reconstruct their lives. So I think it's very poignant that you've picked someone who's playing so much by the rules of a system, and now tell us what...
And trying to create some kind of emotional dignity and possibility for his life. He borrowed $6,000 from his elderly father's scarce funds to pay for Oikos vocational nursing program. He didn't know when he enrolled what has been reported in the papers, which is that unfortunately it's a nursing program that has the lowest number of graduates who pass the nursing exam. In most colleges in California that give nursing programs, 75% of people pass. At Oikos, 29% of people passed, and only 8 people from the graduating class that he saw even got jobs, and they weren't good ones. When he became aware of this, he was panicked. He felt he had taken his father's scarce funds. He had grasped at this rope that seemed to lead to a boat that was a lifeboat, and instead he was being dropped into the icy ocean of debt and emotional loss and dignity loss.
And no job on the horizon.
And no job after all of this. So he went to Ellen Cervellin, who was the administrator at Oikos, and said, look, the semester just started. I want my tuition back for this semester. He was told no. He then asked for a prorated portion of that tuition. He was refused. He was devastated.
And they have the legal right to refuse this?
They have the legal right to refuse it and keep the money. And keep the money that the federal government pays when the federal government subsidizes these programs, which is very painful. At any rate, he went back looking for a way to assert himself as a man, and he got a gun. He came looking for Ellen Cervellin, didn't find her, and like quite a few rampage killers, he then lined up and killed many classmates, 7 of them, and shot others. He realized he was at the end of his rope, and unlike younger men, he was middle-aged by that time, who joined the army looking for a chance to assert themselves as men and go off and kill Afghanistanis and Iraqis. He found his manhood in his own gun and killed his fellow students.
So in a sense, it illustrates the way you introduced what you were telling us, that in a sense, the system hit this man twice. First, by depriving him of the job he had, in which he was performing very well.
Yes.
And then saying to him, in the misery and trouble he had trying to cope with losing his job, holding out the prospect of making money off of him a second time by getting him to enroll in a program that made money for an institution but left him even further behind because of his borrowing than he had been when he lost his managerial job.
And offered no hope. And, you know, Rampage, it's an interesting side note to point out, as Mark Ames did in his excellent book, Going Postal, that Rampage killings, which are a part of the fabric of American life, are not known elsewhere. There are occasional scary killings like there were in Norway. There hadn't been anything like that in their history that they could remember. Or the killings in Toulouse, France. But these are wild anomalies, whereas same month of April, several students had been killed in high school in California. That this is a part of the fabric of our lives, and it wasn't always with us. Rampage killings started with the war against the working class in 1980, which the mid-1980s, with Reagan, who was socking it to and decimating people's lives by crushing the unions. And this began with the postal unions, which is where the expression going postal started. But it spread to schools and workplaces across America. It's a way that people, not a way I would certainly condone, but a way that people desperate do the American thing, pick up a gun, man's thing.
And again, to be the economist for a moment before we take our musical break, think with me about the tens of thousands of other people who suffered comparable 1-2 punches, losing their job and then turning to another option only to discover it's another way of making money at their expense and getting depressed, becoming alcoholic, having their relationships fall apart. I mean, it is the beginning of a chasm to open up yourself to this, to realize what the costs of the instability of this economic system really are when you are daring enough to look at the actuality. Friends, I'm going to ask for us to have a short musical break, and we'll be back to continue our conversation with Dr. Harriet Fraud. This is Richard Wolff on Economic Update. Dangerous questions in the English language. Why? Just one word. And everything changes in societies when people look around them, face the reality, and begin seriously to ask and pursue why. That's what we're trying to do here, and I want to turn back and say to Dr. Fraud, look, you told us there was a second example, or at least a second area where you could explore this that had something to do with economic downturns in a capitalist system and this astonishing explosion of money being made by and outlets for pornography.
Yeah. This is just another illustration. Of course, sadly, there aren't only two. There were so very many from which to choose. But this is a particularly lucrative area. Pornography, as I said before, is, I think it's a $97.6 billion industry. And a tenth of American adults are addicted to pornography. Most of them, 83%, are males. And if we look at what's happened to males in America since the recession, we'll maybe get a sense of why. And then we'll look at the devastation of pornography on American relationships. In since this, there's a slow process that had been happening to the mid since the mid-70s when male wages flattened and profits kept going up. And the people at the top had accumulated more and more and more and bought the airwaves, not BAI, of course, and bought the media and bought the senators and congressmen and government. But within that picture, 80% of the jobs that were lost in this recession were typically male jobs, jobs for which you didn't need an advanced degree, but that offered males a reasonable living. And those were jobs in construction, jobs in heavy machinery, jobs in manufacture, jobs in big ticket sales. Now, these are areas that have all been desperately hard hit. And so American men have taken quite a hit. They no longer can support their wives and children. Now, we should say that white American males were given two supplements in their wages. They used to be given a higher wage, one for being male and another for being white. All women and minority males never got family wages, but white males did. And all males have got better wages than females, and all males are suffering. Now,
so the argument is that the economic downturn has, in a sense, whacked males over females and white males more than non-white? Or is it mainly a male-female?
Male-female.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because if you look at in the early 70s, women worked and earned 59% on the male dollar, and that was regardless of race or ethnicity. Now that's changed. Women make 77 cents on a male dollar. And women who are in what has been traditionally female jobs, the social service sector, where 6 out of 7 American jobs are, women have lost their jobs less frequently than men. So that men are particularly unmanned. If you look at your manhood in a sense of you being a provider and the head of your family, that's gone. It had been a lot more gone for minorities for a lot longer, and they attributed minority family breakup to inherent minority pathology, which was, of course, racist and wrong. It was the economy that struck males, and now it's striking white males and minority males as well. So that in the new America, white women who are college educated and 30 or younger, who are in metropolitan areas, earn more than their male counterparts.
Yes, I noticed also that recently I was doing research, and it's becoming very clear that a growing majority of students able to enter and complete 4-year colleges and even 2-year colleges are women. That the population of higher education, which used to be tipped much more to male than female, has not only gotten over that, but the tipping is now going the other way.
The other way. In fact, most graduates not only of college, but master's degree and doctoral programs are women in all but a few areas. And so what we're talking about is a change in male dominance now.
And in male sense of what they can do and what's likely to provide them with jobs.
And the stability of their families.
And they're adjusting to the decline of the economic system's opportunities for them.
That's right. And they're left alone with this.
Right.
Because in a just society, as wages became equal or slightly less for men, they would supplement the traditional domestic work that was assigned to women as men were in the workforce by creating what they have in every other Western industrialized nation, subsidized after-school care and child care, subsidized housing for single women and poorer families, free health care, free elder care, the kinds of things that crush families. And they would help people work out equal relationships. They would have subsidized counseling and programs and educational programs. For example, Norway and Sweden insist that men have paternity leaves as well as women have their paid maternity leaves. The United States is the only country in the Western world that has no paid maternity leave at all. But they insist that both men and women have these leaves and have family time and vacation time required by law so that all parents can interact with their children.
Yeah, just a footnote because it's an important point. The United States makes more of so-called family values across the political spectrum than in any other country I'm aware of. It provides no paid maternity and paternity leave to enable families to take care of children when they arrive, which is a crucial part of the family. In the European countries, those you cite and many others, which don't make such a big deal about family values, they almost all have a much more generous program of paternity, maternity, social work, help for young families, and so on, precisely to make the process of family life easier financially and in every other way. So it's a stunning disconnect between the self-image of the United States and its economic reality.
That's certainly true. I mean, France has 5 weeks paid vacation, and so it's a
by law.
And we are the only one. We have the fewest vacations of any of the industrialized world, so that we're depriving people of the chance they need to both make an income and work something out and have time with their families.
Anyway, because of time, take us back to this argument about pornography.
Well, I want to go back and say one more thing
about
this phenomenon before I get there, which is within this environment in which men are not getting a better education on how to make egalitarian, equal, caring relationships and are not, as much as they need to be, assuming domestic roles for which they're not prepared and not encouraged, women are rejecting marriage. Most divorces are now initiated by women. A huge number of women refuse to get married in the first place because they are required to take care of a man's domestic needs and a home and the children and work for an unemployed man. The average unemployed man does less domestic work than his fully employed wife, so that a lot of women are opting out. 42% of all children are born outside of a marriage. And so that this means men are being rejected.
You mean both in the employment situation and in their personal
lives? In their personal lives. And this society offers a few refuges for male dominance. One is the military. Another is the Christian right. Another is the NRA culture, the gun culture, which a lot of men take advantage of when they go on rampage shootings. And another is pornography. Pornography is the most available, the most lucrative, the most pervasive. Children start looking at porn when they're 11. Now that the Christian right has taken sex ed out of a lot of the schools, relationships of dominance and subordination in heterosexual pornography are the way kids get a sexual education. And I have a client whose husband is a porno addict, which means that he has ignored her sexually. He ignores the kids. He's totally mesmerized. He's unemployed, and he spends his time in front of the screen getting aroused by objects. For the first time in American history, 10% of males from colleges are saying they fake orgasms. A large percentage of young people, particularly males, can't get aroused without pornography. So even if they're in a relationship, they're basically having a relationship with a pornography image rather than a real person. What this does in terms of
art. Does this just, as a layperson, does this qualify as an addiction in the classic sense of the term?
Yes, it's an addiction in that one can't stop, one is filled with shame, one spends money on it that one doesn't have. One can't get through a day without.
So it is classic.
It is a classic addiction. And what it means is the already terrible pressures on family and on men and women, even in dating. If you have a percentage of the population that would rather date their computer porn image, what are you doing? In the most intimate arena of human connection, you're making a disconnection. And the ramifications are huge. They're huge in dating. They're huge in relationships between men and women. They're huge in terms of what sex is, which was an ultimate connection, and now it's an ultimate connection with a paid-for image, that we are the same product, the same capitalist product of porno, which is being sold to assuage men's sense of lost masculinity with their lost earning power, is now making them addicted, dysfunctional, shamed, and incapable.
Now I see the parallel in your two examples, because men who are deprived of jobs and incomes by the changing capitalist problem and the Great Recession that we're in are then searching for some solution to this suffering.
Recoup their masculinity.
And then they're approached by another capitalist enterprise, the porno industry, which is a way out, not the best one, but one that they can choose because it is so profitable and so available, and leaves them then addicted when the dust settles from all of it.
Exactly. And there are people who've written about this. Hedges writes wonderfully about this, that what has happened is that with this capitalist product, particularly in hetero porno, homosexual porno is different. Women are routinely humiliated. And according to interviews with pornographers, this is the revenge of the male who can't get a job, who can't feel like a man because a man dominated a woman. And they get more and more violent and more dominating, which sets out a propaganda about relationships, which is terrifying. Just like you're a man when you have a gun is a kind of refuge that is terrifying and leads to the kind of rampage killings in which America is quite unique.
I think the important, or at least one important lesson, in a sense, of everything you've told us today is that a proper society reaction to an economic system that plunges into downturns as often as this capitalist system we have does, and as badly as it frequently does, and we are, cannot say this more often enough, in the fifth year now of the current downturn, has unbelievable social costs. I mean, you've detailed the spinning into murderous rage of one person as an example. And now you have a whole class of persons deprived of what they had come to expect, jobs they had, prospects they had, turning to a easily available, profitable industry that's all around them as a kind of solace, as a kind of consolation for their diminished opportunities, making them only addicted and making their suffering worse. If I could add something, it isn't just the personal and emotional and family and relationship disasters that this system's instability contributes to. These things have a way of coming back to damage the economy too. Porno-addicted people, that affects your work.
Yep.
People who are caught up in a rage, even if it doesn't result in murder or anything like that, are people who are going to get sick sooner mentally and physically, who are going to be therefore absent from the job, perhaps at a crucial time. No one knows how to count all the economic costs except to know that they are enormous. And the tragedy is that when the society debates programs to help unemployed, to help those denied a job through no fault of their own, to help those impacted by economic shifts that are not their doing, we're told, gee, we can't afford that.
The irony is, if you look at what it actually costs, it's the worst economic mistake, even setting aside its moral, ethical, and emotional cruelty.
It certainly is, because one of the things that's happened is that as more and more mothers are single mothers, because they can't count on men to help them, there are fewer and fewer supports, fewer good public programs to educate women for jobs, fewer child care slots. And Cuomo just got defeated trying to get out, trying to reduce the help for disabled children. The misery and the anger. And also, if I could, just for a moment,
please,
to look at the impact on children, the most helpless citizens. With one, you know, poor women, mothers are the poorest of women. Mothers get 30% less in salary than anyone else because they're distracted. You can't stay late for overtime and so on. And of the people who are the desperately poor, and those are people who make less than $9,000 a year for a family of four, they're overwhelmingly mothers of single mothers. And what does that mean for their children who don't even get enough to eat? What does it mean to Americans that one in four families is on food stamps and doesn't have enough? The desperation, the sense, and also within America, the sense of personal inferiority, because money makes you valuable. You know, there's a prestige with money, and you're nobody when you're poor. That these are terrible, terrible scourges to pass on to innocent people who are trying desperately to make a life, like one Elgo tried. And like many of the men who get hooked on porn, want to recoup some sense of self and manhood, which is being stolen by this capitalist economy, which then sells them a profitable product, which then destroys their life even further.
Dr. Farhad, thank you again for coming on the program. I hope you'll be available to come back and continue this dimension of the analysis of the economy. You know, one of the things you learn when you do economics in a humane way is that the boundary between economics and other fields, whether it's psychology or history or literature or medicine, those boundaries are artificial, shouldn't really be there, because to understand the crisis of this economy requires you to go further afield, literally. And we've tried to do that a little bit, and with your help, Harriet, it's been a big assistance to moving in that direction.
Thank you very much.
In our remaining time today, let me respond to a couple of your comments and your questions. One of you, in fact, actually several of you, commented on my discussion a week or two ago about public transportation, trying to explain, as I did, that the automobile is a stunningly inefficient and wasteful product of our economic system. It kills more people than anything else in our society. It injures more people every year. It's the single largest polluter of the air. It uses much more oil than we need to move people. If we had a public transportation system, we would save on the oil and the pollution and the injury and the death. It's a no-brainer. And some of you said, yes, yes, but how would I get around the suburbs where I have need a car to get my child to school and another car to get myself to the job and another car to get us to the mall to do our shopping? I understand that. There are ways in which our system now in this country has been adjusted over the last 75 years to the automobile. Indeed, there's plenty of evidence to indicate that the producers of cars wanted us to leave the cities of the United States and move instead to the suburbs, because what you don't need in a city is a car, and what you have to have in a suburb is a car. And that has something to do with the car industry being so important in American history in the last 75 years. If we want to get off of our unhealthy and uneconomical and inefficient dependence on the private car, we have to recognize that that will require planned, organized adjustments in our society. But here's a quick transition. In many countries, there's something done with vans, jitneys, little automobiles that have seats for a dozen folks, more or less. We could have a system in which we move our people basically by train and by big bus to points in any suburb, and then from that radiate out these little vans which go up and down the street and go to all the little corners that our modern suburban culture has created. That would be an interim solution while we reconstruct our living situations so that we can rely more on public transportation. That would save us unspeakable amounts of money. It would do more to deal with air pollution than anything else. It is a real solution. And the fact that we now live in an irrational living structure based on making money for the car industry is precisely why we shouldn't waste another minute in beginning to make the transition so that we're not dependent on that way. And indeed, that transition would allow people who lose jobs in an automobile factory to gain them in one of these jitney or van factories as the transition is made. And lest you worry that the suburban streets where you may live would then be crowded with jitneys, remember, the jitneys replace the private cars so that the traffic would be less, not more. That's why there's less pollution and less injury and so on. This is a challenge that we are long overdue in taking. The United States is behind other countries in creating places in modern cities where cars are not allowed to go, in utilizing the model of the private car rental service to have big lots at the edges of our cities and towns where cars are kept for everybody's use. It becomes a social benefit, and it no longer becomes a private profit maker. That's the efficient way to go. We'll see whether our capitalist system allows it. Last point for today before we have to close. One of you sent in a question, has anyone ever calculated the cost of privatizing things the government does? So instead of having the government pick up the garbage, have a private person do it, and instead of the government running a parking lot, have a private concessioner do it. The answer is we don't have very good information about it. And partly that's because it's very difficult to figure out what all the consequences are of moving a parking lot from a public agency to a private. Both of them can do terrible mistakes and be terribly inefficient. There's no easy answer. Many times a public sector works better. Many times it doesn't work as well. But here's one thing always to keep in mind. When a public entity runs a stadium, a parking lot, a school, a hospital, a business, they have to pay for the costs of producing. They have to pay people's wages. They don't have to make a profit too. When a private entity does something, it still has to pay for the costs of the labor and of the materials. But on top of that, it has to raise the price to make a private profit. Something to keep in mind when thinking about the choice between private and public and collective. Thank you all again for being with me on Economic Update. Please come and join us next week. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Harriet Fraud, and ask her again, on behalf of all of us and the interest that our listeners have shown, whether you come and join us again in the future.
I would love to. Thank you.
Thank you all, and see you next week. Time now, baby.